Good day, and welcome to the Sigma Eating Disorder Awareness Series conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Kim Sager-Himmler. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Welcome, and thank you for calling into Sigma's 2014 Eating Disorder Awareness Series. My name is Kim Sager-Himmler, and I'm a lead clinician with Sigma. Due to the format of the call today, you will not be able to ask questions during the teleconference. However, at the end of the conference, there will be a brief five-question survey in which we are requesting your feedback on your experience of today's seminar. After this survey, you will be able to ask questions of today's speaker. A handout for the presentation is available online at www.cigna.com/eatingdisorders. Halfway down the page, under the heading Current Topics, you will see the link for today's presentation in blue entitled Selective Eating, the Role of Sensory Sensitivity, Gut Feelings, and Disgust. Again, visit the Awareness Series page online at www.cigna.com/eatingdisorders. Halfway down the page, under the heading Current Topics, you will see the link for today's presentation in blue entitled Selective Eating, the Role of Sensory Sensitivity, Gut Feelings, and Disgust. Please also notice the blue square in the top section of the page that you may click on to sign up for future seminars. It is not required that you sign up in order to attend the monthly seminars. However, if you choose to sign up, you will receive email reminders for each month's presentation. Today I have the pleasure of introducing our speaker, Dr. Nancy Zucker. Dr. Zucker is the director at Duke Center for Eating Disorders. Today she will be sharing information with us on selective eating. Welcome, Dr. Zucker.
Thank you very much, Kim. Devin, I'll give you just a minute to get the handouts if you want. The handouts are actually a copy of the slides that I use to guide this talk, and I will try as we go throughout this talk to reference the slide number so you can follow along. You should hopefully be able to understand what I'm saying without the slides, but just in case. So this is my first time doing a webinar like this, so this should be hopefully fun for everyone. I hope by the end of this 45 minutes that all of you will understand all that I know about selective eating, including kind of who and when, kind of the course of it, and then with treatment. So I want to begin. Well, let me do what I promised and give you just a minute to pull up handouts and get good at managing my computer. So I want to begin our talk about selective eating by talking about terms. If you are a clinician, someone suffering from selective eating, or a parent, one of the things that's challenging in looking at the web or trying to do your own research is we're using a lot of different names to describe what we mean by selective eating. For example, there's the term food neophobia. Food neophobia refers to a fear of trying new foods. For the selective eaters that I'm talking about, they all have that quality in common. Nearly all of them are afraid of tasting a food that they have not tried before. You may have come across a term called sensory food aversion. I like that term okay because it actually gives reference to the fact that many of these children and adults are actually rejecting food not because of some character flaw or temperament issue, but because of the sensory qualities of the food, which I'm going to talk a great deal about today. You may have heard of the term fussy eater. I don't care for this term at all because it blames the person eating the food as if there's just a difficult child, which is not at all the case. The term selective eater is kind of where I've landed, because it points to the fact that the food variety repertoire is limited, but there's also, and then there's the term picky eater, which I sometimes am forced to use in my research, even though I hate it, because it makes it, again, seem like the child is just being difficult, when in fact that's not the case at all. There's a new term that I really want people to be aware of by the end of this talk, and that is because there's a new diagnosis in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, and it's called Avoidance and Food Restriction Intake Disorder, AFRID. That's a mouthful, so I like the acronym, AFRID. I'll say that again so people can write that down, AFRID. And what that is a catch-all, and I'll talk about that a bit, where certain forms of selective eating may fall into. If I had my choice and I could name named selective eating whatever I wanted. I call it these children and adults sensitive eaters because that's what they are. These are people with these sensory superpowers. They have exquisite abilities to sense taste, texture, smell, and emotional experience. And I hope by the end of this talk I'll make that very clear. So when we're talking about a, and I'm going to use the term sensitive eater throughout the talk. So when we're talking about a sensitive eater, what kinds of features are we talking about? Well, one, they restrict the intake of food type, right? So the one thing that's true of all sensitive eaters is that their food variety is limited. At this point, I'm on slide number 4 for those of you who are following along. They also have very strong food preferences. They have very, if you have encountered a sensitive eater, they have very determined and decided opinions about what foods are good and what foods are bad, and there is no gray with these children and adults. Many of them are unwilling to try new foods. Certainly all the ones that the individuals that I work with are unwilling to try new foods. And for a subset, and this subset is the more severe subset, they're also unwilling, they eat a limited amount of food. And I'm going to hopefully give you an organizing framework to understand that important difference, right? So they all restrict food type, and some of them also restrict food amount. So as we get into it, I want to dismiss, if I do nothing else today, I want to dismiss the myths that parents have been told by their doctors that I want to just kind of blow out of the water. Myth number one is that he'll grow out of it. And I say he because sensitive eaters are different in that are unlike disorders like anorexia, bulimia, the sex distributions of sensitive eating seems to be more equal. In fact, there's some data that it may even affect more boys than girls. So in your slide pack, your handout, slide 6, is some data from a study that I include, a graph that I included for everyone to look back on because it's a really fascinating graph. This is a cohort study done at Stanford where they looked at about 250 new mothers, and they looked at the children's eating, among other things, beginning at the age of 8 years old. One of the things that was most interesting to me about this study was that if they asked mothers at 8, is your child a picky eater? And for the mothers that said their child was most of the time or always a picky eater, they then went back and looked at early differences at birth of these children, and they found that these children actually had a different suck rate even at birth in terms of their breastfeeding, the amount of their kind of the strength of their suck, their ability to get milk. So I just thought, so in terms of supporting the biological nature of sensitive eating, I thought that was very important. The take-home message from this graph is that new cases, that's that incidence of selective eating, peak at about 2, then they peak again about 5, and then they kind of level off, so that most of the people that become sensitive eaters are becoming sensitive eaters very early in development, but that there's about 15% of children and adults who persist in their selective eating, and this way at least until adolescence. But the overall prevalence of sensitive eating is about 20%. So what that means in English is there's about 5% of children and adults who will grow out of being a selective eater or a sensitive eater, but there's a significant proportion that will remain a sensitive eater, and I think that that's important. We actually did the first study of adults with sensitive eating. The folklore before we did the study was just that the children will grow out of it, certainly by adolescence. So what we did is, and clinically, that's not what I was seeing. I was seeing adults present to my clinic with sensitive eating. It was hugely impairing, not so much in terms of their weight, because as an adult they could manage the amount of food that they ate, but in terms of their social life and their occupational functioning. So we actually put a survey out with the help of a health editor from the Wall Street Journal, just basically describing the phenomenon of adult sensitive eating, and ask any adults who felt that they were a sensitive eater to go ahead and click on the link and fill out our survey. And then I got no work done that day because I was just watching my computer, seeing how many people would fill out the survey. And we were really hoping for about 600 folks, right? Maybe the only 600 folks in the world that had adults who are adults with sensitive eaters, but we were astounded, of course, because about 40,000 people responded to our survey, and we subsequently were able to and continue to look at this data and see what it is about these adults who are sensitive eaters. The folks that we found, the characteristics that describe these adult sensitive eaters were they're more likely to be male. There was no racial or ethnicity differences. In our sample, they were less educated than the other groups that we looked at. They were less likely to be underweight or less likely to be obese, right? So the take-home from that is they're normal weight, so they're kind of perfect regulators of their appetite. But importantly, they also had less OCD symptoms. Now, the selective eating group was compared to a group that was pure eating disorder, like anorexia and bulimia. They were also compared to a group that had both a classic eating disorder like anorexia and bulimia and selective eating, and they were compared to a low pathology group. So our picky eating, quote, group was not a group that had OCD, and this was very important because one of the beliefs in the field was that folks that are picky eaters really just have this fear of contamination, but that was not the case. Another thing that was important was we learned that this group, the group of sensitive eaters, had higher levels of social anxiety, right? And we believe that comes secondary to these eating issues because eating is such a social thing. And I'll talk more about that in a moment. I'm now on, for those of you following along, slide number 8. We also wanted to look a little bit about, okay, how serious is sensitive eating? Sensitive eating gets a hand wave oftentimes from pediatricians because of this notion that they'll grow out of it. So we wanted to see, okay, is our sensitive eaters, should we be worried about them? So this is a study where we looked at roughly 900 preschoolers, and these were interviews that we conducted in their home, and we asked mothers and fathers to describe their child's eating, and children were rated up whether they were, and this is slide number 9, whether they didn't have any sensitive eating, where they only ate a limited range of foods, or that eating with others was difficult, so 3 getting really into impairment. And what we found in a nutshell was that even at lower levels of sensitive eating, the children who were more likely to have symptoms of depression, anxiety, and ADHD. But importantly, and this was a huge relief for parents, our sensitive eaters were less likely to have symptoms of oppositional defiant disorder or conduct disorder, right? So these were, our sensitive eaters were worried, anxious, and sad kids. They weren't bratty kids. Now, I'm not saying oppositional defiant disorder is a bratty kid by any means, but it wasn't just because they were disobeying, right? And that was hugely important because the feedback that we got from parents was that this was a parenting issue, that the only reason why their children was a sensitive eater is because the parents were being so indulgent. So this data was very important in kind of disconfirming that. So my first take-home message from all that data is that for a significant subset of our sensitive eaters, that sensitive eating persists and continues to impair functioning. And so it is indeed an important diagnosis to consider and investigate attention. And my second take-home message is that sensitive eating, which is something that parents are very good at identifying, may be a marker for children that would benefit from early intervention. Our data, particularly our preschool data, went on to show that children who were sensitive eaters early in childhood, that presence of sensitive eating predicted an increase in symptoms of anxiety later. So a very reliable marker of later pathology. The second myth that I want to dissuade, the first one, of course, being that they grow out of it, and now I'm on slide number 13, is that if you just let your child get hungry enough, they'll eat, right? That was a huge one that I feel very strongly about. And my first response to that one is my image that I have in slide 14, which is good luck with that, right? Even if that were true, and I'm about to prove to you that that is not true, any parent, any of you in the audience who are parents who could willingly starve your child, that's just neither feasible nor kind, you know, or practical, all the things that one can imagine. What's wrong with it? But this is an interesting study where we tried to to support why this would be a really bad idea. BASIS is a bad idea because, let me describe this study. This was a study that we did. We wanted to look at the effect of fasting, skipping meals, going for long periods of time without eating, on mood. So we took advantage of an opportunity. It was the Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur, where people fast for 24 hours, and right before the folks were about to break their fast and have their meal, I was there at the temple with all my researchers, and we begged people to just fill out a quick survey right before they started eating, and we asked them to rate their mood as they were going throughout the fast. Now, ideally, folks would have been rating their mood all throughout the fast, but that was against the practices of the religion. So what we found is that predictably, as time went on and people got hungrier and hungrier, the majority of people's mood worsens. There's a subset of people whose mood gets a little bit better, but then that levels off, right? So what this suggests, just at a more basic level, is starving your kid out only puts them in a very negative mood, oftentimes in a very agitated and anxious mood. When we're agitated and anxious, we are more likely to become more rigid and more controlling and clamped down than we are to be adventurous, right? Because we're afraid. So the logic that kind of waiting till your kid gets hungry enough doesn't support anything that we know about emotion regulation and flexibility. So that was a huge relief for some parents who hated that advice. So the take-home message number three is that trying to have a food standoff and starve them will not work. So the casualties, of course, for all this are the children, but the second casualty, and the adults who are still struggling, but the second casualty is the parents. One of the things that really struck me as we started to do the study of adult sensitive eaters and publicity increased about the nature of sensitive eaters and picky eaters was I would get these letters, these handwritten letters from women, you know, in their mid-70s, 80s, kind of thanking us for doing this research because they had felt so guilty their whole lives that somehow it was due to their parenting or the way they were feeding their children, and they felt so horrible about that. So it was a huge relief for them to know that sensitive eating is a biologically based illness that their children were struggling with, and it wasn't a function of anything that they were doing. We asked parents how satisfied they were with the advice that were given by their healthcare providers, and whether they felt the medical profession had been supportive of their concerns of their child's eating. And about 3/4 of parents felt that no, that they were not supportive. So, and this is, you know, this points to that we need to do a better job of getting research and information out to providers so that parents feel more supportive, because providers just don't have the resources that they need to manage this. So now I'm on slide 20. I wish I could open up for questions, but we'll do that at the end. So one question one could ask after presenting kind of some of this is, does selective eating fall within this new AFRA diagnosis? If you have a selective eater, a sensitive eater, do they actually meet criteria now for a clinical disorder, right? And so let's look at the criteria, right? So to meet criteria for avoidant restrictive food intake disorder, you have to have eating or feeding disturbance resulting in either nutrition deficiency, growth deficiency, dependence on enteral feeding or nutritional supplements, right? Many of the children that I see, they're growing and they're doing okay, but if you look at their diet, they're just drinking Pediasure, or an interference in psychosocial functioning. So is a sensitive eater a form of AFRID? And the answer is it certainly could be. So now I'm going to move into the next part of my talk, which is kind of the what and the why. In my first part of my talk, I kind of talked about the who and the when development, and who are these people. Now I want to talk about what it, the nature of sensitive eating, so we can really kind of get underneath the skin of folks that are struggling with this. And slide number 24 is a complicated quote that I will read slowly. This is from a colleague of mine named Chris Harshaw, and he did a wonderful review on the emergence of hunger. And he writes that there's a counterintuitive conclusion that despite their critical role to survival, the phenomena of hunger, thirst, and satiety are not innate, hardwired, or genetically programmed, but are instead the product of individual development. And I raise this only to bring out the intriguing point that you would think that it would be so hard to disrupt a child's capacity to feed. But anyone who's ever breastfed can tell you that working out the early developmental machinations of establishing a feeding relationship is far from easy. And there's lots, and we are organisms that easily learn associations, right? So if I, you know, continually at mealtimes experience pain or stress or discomfort whenever I eat, I'm going to come to associate eating with dread, and I'm not going to, and as a result of that, I'm just not going to enjoy food. And the fact that there could be children out there who, through their experiences, have learned to not enjoy food and to dread eating, it's hard for people to get their heads around, but certainly quite possible. So how could this happen? Well, you know, certainly if we, every time we ate, we experienced pain, right? Children with GERD or acid reflux, right, in the early feeding days, you know, they're feeding and then they're experiencing pain, and we have very little data to understand how these early feeding pain associations would affect the development of what we call the gut-brain axis, right, which is that connection between our gut and our brain that helps communicate to the brain the state of our stomach and our energy needs. Our muscle tone affects our ability to feed properly, right? If we are born with an underdeveloped mouth, a musculature, our ability to get food early in life can become impaired. Our ability to breathe, things like asthma, you know, when we eat, we actually, you know, we're obstructing our airway with food, the ability to kind of get in enough oxygen, you know, would impair the pleasure of eating. I went to this great lecture where the lecturer made the comment, you know, people think that eating is the most primary basic need that will do anything to be able to eat. And she made the point, actually, if given the choice, people would rather breathe than eat, which is so true. That's Kay Toomey who I quote saying that. So these early developmental events, my research focuses on how do these early developmental events actually affect the development of this gut-brain axis. So even if the GERD is treated, even if now allergies are treated, even if now my child has worked with an occupational therapist and worked on his muscle tone, you know, are these very strong, what we call visceral memories that are still impacting my child's association with eating, even though he has no memory of this and can't articulate any of this. So slide 27 is the way I think of feeding disorders in children, particularly sensitive eating. And the way I organize feeding disorders in children is I think about the digestive system. And I find that AFRID, even though it's a welcome addition to the DSM-5, is not specific enough to be helpful in terms of a clinician really figuring out how to intervene. So when I think of sensitive eaters, I think about first, you know, their sensitivities, right? If we think about digestive system, we're going to start at the mouth, and my sensitive eaters are more sensitive to texture often. They're often more sensitive to smell, and they're very sensitive to taste, right? So orally, taste, texture, and smell, they experience oftentimes very strong flavors. If we think about the throat, you know, and I'm going to talk about this more in a moment, because these senses are so strong, they experience an aversion with taste that I'll talk about. So they oftentimes have a very sensitive gag reflex, and new foods actually make them gag and sometimes vomit. As we move down the GI tract, some of these children are very sensitive to how their gut feels, right? So they become very sensitive to feelings in their gut, very afraid of feelings in their gut, so they become very sensitive to feelings of fullness. And then, as a result of not eating a balanced diet, not getting enough fiber, etc., oftentimes they become constipated, and this further inhibits the desire to feed, right, because they feel bloated all the time, they feel uncomfortable, they feel full. Now, the interesting part of that, of this kind of train of sensitivities along your GI tract, so what I see clinically is oftentimes children have sensitivities all along that digestive axis, but sometimes they don't, right? Sometimes they just have the oral sensitivities, the gag sensitivities, but they don't have this GI sensitivity, but oftentimes they do. What I think that's so interesting about their sensitivity to their gut is if you think about feelings like guilt, disgust, you know, think about, you know, imagine something really disgusting. Just go ahead and imagine it and just pay attention and make a disgusted face, you know, and you can just feel your gut clench up if you don't put your hands on your stomach. You know, so these kids who are my sensitive eaters, you know, the take home is that they're very sensitive to how their body feels. So they feel, because emotions we also feel in our bodies, emotions are embodied, these children also have very strong feelings, right? They have very strong feelings of disgust. They're very self-conscious, right? Because we think of guilt and shame as being a very visceral gut feeling. So these are just very sensitive children, and that's what parents tell me. It's like, but he, you know, she just loves everything. She loves people. She's so warm-hearted. She's just so kind. These are just very sensory, sensitive children. So not to belabor that, but I wanted everyone to get that. So I want to belabor it for one more moment, because I think that the literature has really focused on insensitive eaters. The role of anxiety, that these children are afraid to eat, that they're afraid something bad is going to happen. But my experience is that these children are actually in addition, very disgust sensitive, right? It's not that they're afraid something bad is going to happen. You know, they know logically that everyone else is eating this food and nothing bad is going to happen, but they just have a very strong sensory aversion, and they experience disgust where most people would not. And just to drill this point home a bit more, you know, if you think about sensitivity to our gut, that's where we have gut feelings, right, where we have our rapid intuitive judgments that we make about things, and that is these children's experience, right? A parent will put a new food in front of them, well, they have this very strong gut reaction that somehow this is wrong, they shouldn't eat this, but just like gut feelings that you just can't explain them, you just kind of feel that way. These children can't articulate why they think that. They just feel that it's wrong. So to drive this home, I threw some data into your slides that I don't need to belabor. But basically, parents report that when their sensitive eater is presented a new food, 88% of them are very likely to make a disgusted face. In our adults who are sensitive eaters, the more severe their sensitive eating, the more severe their disgust experience, which is very interesting. And further, that nearly 75% of folks who filled out a survey of sensitive eaters will gag 75% of the time when presented with a new food, right? So clearly a very, very strong disgust response. So my take-home message is that sensitive eaters have a disgusted reaction to what most of us experienced as non-noxious taste. They have strong gut feelings and sensory aversions that make eating challenging. Now I'm going to get a bit into treatment strategies, and you're going to understand a bit why I spent a bit of time talking about disgust. And that is because there's a big difference between fear conditioning and disgust conditioning. In fear conditioning, as we do for like obsessive compulsive disorder or a dog phobia, we give some psychoeducation, perhaps, about dogs. We work up a hierarchy of feared dogs. And then through experience, we gradually work on exposing someone to these dogs or spiders or whatever it is. And so let's say I have a spider phobia, and I, through this wonderful exposure-based treatment, learn that spiders actually are not going to harm me. Well, at the end of it, I still won't like spiders very much. Right, that experience hasn't changed my evaluation of spiders. And when we think about disgust conditioning, we think of disgust as an evaluation of something. And it has found that mere exposure with disgust doesn't work as well. One, it takes a lot more time. It's a lot more slow to change. And so it may be that for the sensitive eaters, the mere exposure, we need to do more than that. It's just not enough. And so, and this is right now, we're on slide 35, which is what I just talked about, that extinction doesn't work. So our challenges in working with a disgust-sensitive child is that they have intense self-awareness, they're very viscerally sensitive, they have strong emotional reactions and strong gut feelings, and so we've got to invent some novel strategies to do this. Where I often start, and I'm going to talk about the specifics, but one of the things that I take into account before I'm kind of digging in and working with a child who's a sensitive eater is I'm thinking about process issues. I'm thinking about the context in which the feeding environment is currently happening, because feeding a child in particular or an adult with a sensitive eater is such an emotional issue that there may need to be a lot of preliminary work to get the parents to a place where they can engage in what we'll call food adventures without being stressed out and upset just because they've had so many repeated failures. So we borrow from work that we have done previously in working with parents who have a child with anorexia nervosa, where we really worked with parents on a few key things. Now I'm on slide 40. One, we worked with parents on their parenting style and what we are trying to help parents to be able to do in the context of feeding. These are wonderful parents. Feeding was just so challenging. Is to strike a balance between being a warm, permissive parent and being an overly firm and dictatorial parent, right? And strike it in the middle, right, where they were warm and firm, right, which is supported by a huge body of literature on parenting. So for the sensitive eater, you know, where are you warm and where are you firm? And where we draw the line in terms of sensitive eating is the child has to eat enough food. Right, we can draw the line and be like, you've got to eat enough food to be able to play sports today. It is a fair place for them to draw a line, and we can work slowly and methodically on food variety given their disgust experience. But we can't be flexible about food amount, right? Because that has direct implications in terms of their growth. The food variety does also, but we've got a little more wiggle room with that. And one of the things I always help parents to do is that if the child who we've talked about already is incredibly self-conscious, right, if the focus is on this child making changes with eating, you know, that's even more attention that's drawn to the child, right, the child feels overwhelmed. So the degree to which we can make this a family problem, not even with the whole family working on eating, but everyone in the family working on something that they struggle with, it'll be a hugely much more successful intervention right out of the gate. So one of the things that I also help parents with before we get into the eating is their own emotion awareness and regulation and their ability to recognize the emotions and help regulate the emotions of their child. And on slides 42 and 43, I just kind of walk you through a metaphor that I and lots of others use in terms of thinking about emotional arousal. So the short version is that as we start to get more emotionally intense, our access to logic and ration goes away, right? So there's a point at which when we're at our most angry, our most anxious, our most depressed, and there's just no way to reason oneself out of it. The only thing that, and we call that being on top of the wave, that we've crossed the logic line, that the only strategies that work at that level of emotional intensity are sensory strategies, right? And so when we are with our partner and, you know, he's screaming about that he's had a horrible day and we're trying to talk to him about how, you know, how successful he is at his job, right, we're not getting anywhere, right? What's needed is for us to just kind of take his hand and go for a walk, a slow walk around the block, right? And it's the same for these parents with their children, if their children are having meltdowns and temper tantrums because they're so anxious about eating, and we're trying to talk to them, you know, why are you so scared of this? Your children, you know, your siblings just ate this. You've had this before. You see, it's just like the pizza that you always eat. None of those things will work. We have to first help parents to connect with their child in a sensory way, and calm everything down, and then start over again. It may be rocking in a rocking chair. It may be sitting on the porch. It may be tickling, playing, hugging, all these things that we did with them as infants. And I think that that's critically important because meal times for families are at the end of a stressful day. Everyone's tempers are short, and we're taking a child who already has negative associations with eating because of these sensory sensitivities, and we're adding another layer of stress if we don't address the emotional context around the meals. So I want to move now into talking a little bit more about that meal context. So now I'm on slide 44. So we recommended something that is at odds, I think, with some recommendations because we feel very strongly about the sanctity of family meals. You know, they're so powerful. They're so protective of a child's mental health that we want to do everything that we can to make mealtimes a place where the family gathers, there's good communication, there's teamwork, we're enjoying whatever food we are eating, you know, whatever type of food we are eating, we're enjoying it. So we give families permission, and we say that the selective eater, the sensitive eater, is not expected to try new foods at mealtimes. And parents experience this as a huge relief. They felt so, they've all gotten to that place because mealtimes have been so conflictual, but being given permission by a professional to not have the new foods tried at mealtimes is a huge relief. However, we do draw a firm line in terms of that the sensitive eater is expected to join the family at dinner, to remain at the table until everyone is finished. For some of these children, that might need to be a gradual progression as they get used to smells. For example, for one child who is very sensitive to smells, he would be sitting in the adjoining room, and then we worked on decreasing the distance between him and the table, got him to the table, then decreased the distance between him and the food that was served, and so on. If the sensitive eater does elect to initiate a new food at mealtime, he earns bonus points. And that the sensitive eater over time has served a very small portion of the same foods as the other family members, but on a separate small plate, right? So we're using mealtimes as a way to become familiar with the smells and sights of foods, but there's no expectation about tasting. So back to our discussed conditioning and reappraisal, right? I mentioned before that with fear conditioning, you can just do exposures, but discussed conditioning, it takes a lot longer and it's not as effective, but I didn't give you any alternatives, right? So now I'm going to give you an alternative. So what one has to do for discussed conditioning is change the context in which things are experienced, right? We all engage in very disgusting things every day. Those of you who are parents and friends, we change diapers, we clean up vomit, we do all kinds of things in the role of parenting that we framed for ourselves as being part of being a parent, right? It hasn't gotten less disgusting, but or maybe it has for some of us, but the meaning of it has changed, right, because it's embedded in this higher purpose, right? That's what we have to do for disgust. We have to embed our experience of food and sensory issues in a higher context, just as nurses do to deal with patients and other professions that deal with disgusting things. Now, I've talked about the context. I talked about we have to kind of create an emotional context to make it meaningful. But there's an important other thing that we have to do first before we even get to the food, and that's we have to validate a person who's been a sensitive eater's experience, right? We have to acknowledge and be willing to listen to their sensory sensitivities, their experiences of disgust, and acknowledge that we know how hard it would be for them to do these changes. Because their experiences, if they've been telling everyone that they have these experiences, and everyone's been invalidating them because, oh, you just need to try it, everyone likes it, you're just not willing to try it, and right and left. And so if they suddenly were to be willing to try new foods and actually have some experiences that they like the foods, they have a huge fear that everyone will just be like, you see, I told you so, right, which is not the case. So I think that this notion of being willing to listen and give them a framework of what's going on with them is hugely important. And the context in which we present to the sensitive eaters is we borrow from the research of Simon Baron-Cohen, who is a famous researcher in the autism spectrum literature, and in terms of dealing with children with autism, but he has a great term that we really like, and he describes children with autism as little systemizers, right? These are children who, because of their sensory sensitivities, the world has so much information, they're just overloaded with sensory information, so they're desperately trying to create order out of chaos, right? So they're systemizers. They try to find systems, right? And they love it when they can find systems that are predictable and understandable, right? And so on slide 49, I just give you some examples of systemizers. So that's what the context we create. We create the, you know, we'll dig in and try to find, you know, the meaningfulness about why these children, you know, what's the value of them eating a larger variety of food in terms of friendships and family. But we also will create a more immediate context in which their food scientists and the tasting and the experiencing that we're doing with food is just that. It's an experiment. It's a sensory experience, right? So we'll do manipulations of foods they already eat. And the important goal is not whether the children like the food or dislike the food. It's what the food tastes like, right? So we're building on their sensory experiences to help them experience new foods. And this is where you can land on a lot of, once we've got that context straight and the validation and the emotional piece and the food scientist context, and we're not dealing with likes and dislikes, there is a lot of literature about there about kind of different ways to do sensory chaining, food chaining, and then we're getting into the area of occupational therapists. So I'm not going to dig in closely to that so much to say that what we do in our program is we start with the foods the child eats, and what we're going to do at first is we start very, very small, jelly belly size bites of things that are building off manipulations and combinations of foods that they already eat. They eat saltine crackers, right? We might start off trying to get some brand flexibility in there. We might use saltine crackers to embed another taste, and that's where our occupational therapies have been so helpful. I wanted to give, in my remaining 2 minutes, I wanted to just say that one thing that we found to be very fun is that these children are so desperate, they feel so strange, they see their friends eating all these foods, that we have started doing groups where we get sensitive eaters together to do their food adventures. Everybody brings 4 foods. They all commit to taking 4 bites of these foods, and really it's basically, there's no, quote, therapy that's going on in these groups. The kids are just chatting together often about Minecraft and just eating their foods, and I think that's been a huge bonding experience for them. And we've also, that the last slide that you have that's rather confusing is an intervention that we're doing called the FBI study that's helping children who are these somatically sensitive kids to be less afraid of their bodies. So I will, on time, end with that, state that, let me summarize the gaps and give you a summary, and then I'll end. So our gaps in our understanding is that we need some tested strategies for disgust conditioning. We need some laboratory studies to help guide how we introduce food. We need to educate healthcare providers, and we certainly need tested interventions for sensitive eaters. So in summary, our sensitive eaters are sensitive people. And if we can catch them early and teach them to capitalize and not be afraid or disgusted, their sensory superpowers will help to develop some truly wonderful individuals. These are just sweet, sweet, sensitive kids. And with that, I will end my talk for today.
Ladies and gentlemen, to help us evaluate and improve our program, please complete the following short survey. After I finish reading the entire question and all the possible responses, please answer by pressing the star key followed by the number that corresponds with your choice. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. If you are a Cigna employee, we ask that you please refrain from participating in the survey. After the last question, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Your individual responses will be kept confidential. Question 1. This session provided me with a better understanding of issues associated with selective eating. Star 1, strongly agree. Star 2, agree. Star 3, disagree. Star 4, strongly disagree. Again, question 1, this session provided me with a better understanding of issues associated with selective eating. Star 1, strongly agree. Star 2, disagree. Star 3, agree. Star 3, disagree. Star 4, strongly disagree. Question 2. This session educated me on ways to help a selective eater. Star 1, strongly agree. Star 2, agree. Star 3, disagree. Star 4, strongly disagree. Question 3. Overall, this session met my expectations. Star 1, strongly agree. Star 2, agree. Star 3, disagree. Star 4, strongly disagree. Question 4. I would recommend this program to others. Star 1, agree. Star 2, disagree. Question 5. Please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with an eating disorder. Star 1, I am an individual with an eating disorder. Star 2, I am a family member of someone with an eating disorder. Star 3, I am a health professional. Star 4, other. And that does conclude our survey. We will now move on to the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on the phone line will indicate when your line is open. Please state your name before posing your question. Again, press star 1 to ask a question. And we'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal for questions. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you do have a question, please press star 1 at this time. And it appears that we have no questions from the phones. I will now turn the call back over to Ms. Sager-Himmler for closing remarks.
Thank you so much for attending, and thank you to Dr. Nancy Zucker for providing such wonderful insights. If you have specific questions about any of the topics discussed today, please contact the Eating Disorder Team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. Please also mark your calendars to join us next month on Tuesday, August 26th at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, when the topic will be related to eating disorders in the college age population. Thank you for attending and have a great day.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's conference. We thank you for your participation.